Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom presents Radio Free Press, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
History doesn't often repeat itself, but the hidden manoeuvring and evasion which is surrounding Rupert Murdoch's attempt to secure total control of the B-Sky B satellite television service mirrors the duplicity of 25 years ago, when the Murdoch press abandoned Fleet Street, moved to Wapping, and provoked a strike by the 5,500 print and production workers who'd lost their jobs. Like the 1984 miners' strike, the 1986 Wapping dispute lasted for a year. And in the words of Linda Melvin, author of The End of the Street, Murdoch's tactics poisoned the world of Fleet Street journalism. The sacked print workers tried to prevent Murdoch's four newspapers, The Times, Sunday Times, Sun and News of the World, being distributed by lorry from Wapping. Night after night, mass pickets were held back by the police, just as we'd seen the previous year when working miners were bussed in during the bitter pit dispute. But the print workers, like the mine workers, faced insurmountable odds. In a secret deal, Murdoch had recruited an alternative team of printers with the help of the rival electricians' union, the EETPU. More importantly, the government was sympathetic to what Murdoch was hoping to achieve. The rest of the newspaper proprietors were only too anxious to see the defeat of the print trade unions, and the police were well versed in their procedures for thwarting mass pickets. With me to reflect on the Wapping dispute and to assess its lasting significance in the rapidly changing media marketplace in Britain are four people who were involved in the dramatic events of January 1986. Tim Gopsill, Anne Field, John Bailey and Granville Williams. Tim Gopsill, I'll start with you. You were on the executive of the National Union of Journalists during the dispute. You've latterly been the editor of The Journalist. Why do you think this Wapping dispute should not be forgotten?
It was a really major historical event, one of the most important events of the 1980s. I would argue even more important than the miners' strike in the effect that it had on the media and political life in Britain afterwards. It was the transformation, not just of the production of newspapers, but the ownership and control of newspapers. It led to the position we have now, where the media are controlled by big corporations whose main interest is making huge rates of profit, and the voice of the workers in having a say over the way the industry is run got significantly less. It was a very significant event.
Anne Field, you were an official of one of the printing unions, SOGAT. You were, I think, a former mother of the chapel, as we say, of the clerical staff. Why do you, as someone so involved in that dispute, think it's right that trade unionists and others should look back on what happened at Wapping?
Because Murdoch provided the template for the delivery of attacks on workers the length and breadth of the land subsequently, particularly in national newspapers and in provincial newspapers, but across all industries. Employers were able to point to the demolition of workers' rights, the demolition of rights of representation, as well as the wholesale, leading to the wholesale destruction of all forms of worker democracy and representation in national newspapers.
John Bailey, you were a proofreader in Fleet Street on one of Murdoch's newspapers, The Sun. You went on to serve on the NGA, the National Graphical Association's strike committee. Do you think it's right, as one of the people who lost out on that dispute, that we should now commemorate what happened 25 years ago?
I don't necessarily think I lost out. I think that it was a very important event, as Tim has said, but very personal. And I feel that what it did in terms of worker representation through the campaign for press and broadcasting freedom, we were given a huge tool, a massive tool to fight Murdoch, the Right of Reply campaign. And what we did demonstrate then, and I think is terribly important, is that we were able to thwart some of what Murdoch was printing, the lies and distortions. And we were hopefully going to salvage something from the reputation of journalists who were working there at the time. So all of these factors, and many others, frankly, were terribly important. But the right of reply stands in my mind as being a milestone in the, in what could have been achieved had we been more perhaps resolute at Wapping.
Granville Williams, you're seen as one of the leading left-wing commentators on media ownership and regulation. How important, looking back, was that Wapping dispute? Did it change the face of media ownership and the media companies of Britain?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what happened in Fleet Street, Murdoch, before the Wapping dispute, it was like the goose that laid the golden egg for Murdoch. He was using the money from Fleet Street to finance a massive expansion. During the period just before the dispute, he had purchased 20th Century Fox Studios. He had made a $2 billion investment in television stations across America. He wanted to make sure that the move to Wapping was absolutely trouble-free, and that's why there was a hidden agenda, duplicity, as you mentioned, in the way that he went about it. But essentially, the revenues from Fleet Street led to the expansion of Murdoch's global media empire.
Now, we're here at the Marx Memorial Library, and this is where there is going to be a multimedia exhibition commemorating the dispute. I've got many memories, too, of covering that dispute for the BBC as an industrial correspondent. And just a few days before the papers were moved to Wapping from Fleet Street, Rupert Murdoch was here in London to present what turned out to be a take-it-or-leave-it offer to the unions. And I was there on the doorstep when he came out of the hotel. Now, we all suspected, that's us, the journalists, that there'd been a covert agreement with this rival union, the electricians, to recruit an alternative workforce. And we asked Murdoch on the doorstep, have you done a secret deal? And his answer could not have been more precise. He said, we have nothing agreed with the electricians union at all. That, of course, was one of Murdoch's many statements, or guarantees, shall we say, that haven't exactly stood the test of time. But it begs the question, was and were the other newspaper proprietors only there, only too keen to see Murdoch get away with his flight to Wapping? Granville, you mentioned a hidden agenda. Was that part of the hidden agenda?
Indeed. If you go back, in the spring of 85, Murdoch had a meeting with his top executives in New York, and that's where they went for the Big Bang idea, that they were going to move to Wapping, nothing to do with the London paper. It was about relocating all of his papers at Wapping. And at the same time, detailed plans were made about how to minimise the impact, because essentially Murdoch's fear was that any disruption to the flow of revenue would have a severe impact. Because he's always financially stretched, Murdoch. His philosophy was borrow, buy, borrow. And as a result, he wanted to make sure that secretly, behind the scenes, there was a very smooth, almost military-style operation. Well, it was military. Security forces, all the rest of it, used to ensure that Wapping was a fortress.
Now, what Granville seems to suggest, John Bailey, is that the print unions were outsmarted, that you didn't see what was coming. How, when you look back on it now, do you look at it? Do you think that the trade unions could have played it differently?
I do. I think that had we had perhaps the correct leadership, we may have taken action more quickly. But I think the action we took in relation to the right of reply was a factor in Murdoch determining that those agreements he'd already made with various sections in Bouverie Street, for example, were not going to be upheld. Another point that you made about Murdoch's duplicity. So I think, yes, we could have been sharper, but I think we did have, and we still have to some degree, a sense that we were the mainstay when it came to trade union organisation. But on the ground level, at the lowest levels, I think we understood precisely where we were. And indeed, at the end of the dispute, we knew that unless we finished the dispute, Murdoch would not be able to move in forwarding Sky.
Now, Anfield, your union, SOGAT, was led by Brenda Dean.
Yes.
And there was some, certainly, sense on the part of the unions that perhaps SOGAT as one of the unions was perhaps keener to do a deal than perhaps the printers belonging to John's union, the National Graphical Association. How did you see that whole dispute as it evolved?
Yeah, I think the important thing really is to underline how important and crucial the London leadership of the unions were at the time, whereas now national union leaderships are generally more perceived as more important. In those days, they weren't. Fleet Street strength, union strength, was based on the chapels and base
and of
workplace
course
branches.
You were a mother of the chapel.
Yes, but not at that time. I was a Fordham official by that time. But the whole of the Fleet Street worker strength was based on the chapels, with the support of the London branches. Now, I take a different view to John about the run-up to the dispute. Sogat chapels chased the management throughout, prior to 1985 and the whole of 1985, chased the management for meetings. The production chapels, the machine chapels, the phototechnicians chapels, and the clerical chapels, all chasing the management. Now, Sogat at that time represented 2,500 workers, by far the biggest section in the dispute, but huge numbers of casual workers as well. Not day-by-day casuals, but people who were not permanently employed at the newspapers, but who were employed on a regular basis, and about 1,500. But we discovered in 1985 that the company was producing dummy runs of the newspapers. They'd signed an agreement with TNT and so on. And at the TUC, we held a council of war in September 1985. And we knew, as leading FOCs and MOCs, Fordham officials in London and at national level, we went to our chapels to try to get them to agree to stop work, because we didn't feel that we could do anything more. We felt that we were being drawn along. And unfortunately, people did not want to stop work at that stage. They could not believe that the cataclysm that was before them was real. They thought that we had a measure of panic and so on. So whilst I will be very critical about certain aspects of the leadership during the course of the dispute, I know that people did not feel that what was about to happen could possibly happen, because it was too horrific to even contemplate.
Now, Anne Field has raised this prospect that this was a bombshell. Tim Gopsill, I'm coming on to the role of journalists specifically in a minute, but let's look at your position. You're on the executive of the National Union of Journalists. You too can see what is going on with these print unions. What was your assessment?
The union, the NUJ, was involved in the negotiations as well, and what the unions were trying to do was to negotiate.
That's right.
Everybody knew actually what was going to happen.
Absolutely.
There was a volcano waiting to burst.
Absolutely.
Technically, it had been possible to produce papers much more cheaply, with much lower workforces, without compositors at all, with cheaper printing, for a decade. It could have happened. Everybody knew it was coming.
Right.
And what the unions were trying to do was to avoid what actually happened.
Exactly.
And they were desperate to do a deal. But Murdoch wasn't interested in a deal. Murdoch wanted the big bang. And so, I mean, I don't think it's right to say that nobody saw it coming. Everybody knew that something
was
going
to happen. But I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that nobody saw it coming. What I'm saying is that workers did not expect that there would not be an agreement. I mean, brinkmanship was the order of the day in national newspapers. Sudden death, in the end, no matter how vile the situation was, there was always an agreement. The year-long lockout of Times newspapers resulted in an agreement. People expected an agreement. They didn't expect that they would be sacked overnight and lose their jobs
But
forever.
Once it happened, all the cards were in Murdoch's hands.
Absolutely.
Murdoch, by
Absolutely.
The way, is a card player. I mean, he's a well-known, a very, very good poker player. And what Granville is saying, the way he plays his hand.
Mm.
And once it started, he had a strike-breaking workforce ready to hand, recruited by the Electricians' Union. He had the law, legal changes brought in by the Thatcher government that restricted picketing and secondary action by other workers in solidarity, which was a big minus for the Fleet Street print unions, that they were legally prevented from taking actions to support their colleagues. He had the police on hand to stop the picketing, and he had the transport. Crucial thing. He arranged for TNT, the road delivery company, to deliver the papers. Absolute transformation. Before that, papers had gone on the trains, and the rail unions would have stopped the trains. Murdoch had all these things in his hands. It was all playing to his advantage once it started.
Now, I'd like to pick up the point that Tim made about the fact that everyone knew in the industry, too, that it was possible to produce newspapers in a cheaper way, with fewer workers. Granville Williams, what we have to accept, and I'm a journalist, is that many journalists believed that the Wapping dispute did lead to considerable new investment in the newspaper industry, and that therefore, and I use this word, John, advisedly, the reputation of greedy printers, what was holding back future development in the industry. Now, you'll have your chance in a moment, but Granville Williams, let's start with you. Were journalists right in their suspicion that the print unions had a stranglehold which was holding back their industry?
No, it's one of the myths about Wapping, the myth of new technology. First of all, look at the record post-Wapping. You did have papers launched, but what was the main barrier? You needed to have tens of millions of pounds to actually start a newspaper. The Independent raised that money. Eddie Shah raised that money for Today. But Today's no more. The Independent, ironically, became the target 10 years later for an attack by Murdoch, predatory pricing to drive it out of existence. But the real myth was this idea that you would be able to launch through the cheap startup of this new technology a range of politically diverse newspapers, special interest newspapers. None of it happened. And I think that's one of the key points, is that before Wapping, the monopoly control of newspapers existed, and post-Wapping, the monopoly of control of newspapers existed. It has nothing to do with new technology. Yes. New technology actually enabled Murdoch and the other newspapers to generate enormous profits and to shift journalism much more towards a consumer style, soft style journalism, because you got the expansion quite cheaply, you could print cheaply, supplements about travel, home, gardening, whatever you want. And that's not necessarily journalism, it's consumer style journalism, but not journalism of the sort that traditionally existed on the Sunday Times pre-Wapping and other newspapers as well.
And now, Granville, thank you. What is so significant, I think, John, is that during this long strike, which went on for a year, you and your connections on the strike committee on the National Graphical Association, what did you think of the fact that whatever Granville says about it being a misconception, other newspaper proprietors were doing deals, weren't they? And other newspapers were shedding print workers. What did you feel as this dispute proceeded during that long, long year?
Well, there's ambivalence about whether we got the support we deserved. And I do resent most strongly, most bitterly, the idea of greedy printers. In almost 20 years working for News International, I was involved in any number of disputes, stoppages, threats of stoppages and so on, in support of other workers. And people forget that, by and large, it was Fleet Street and their superb organisation that led the charge when it came to other less fortunate, less well-organised workers trying to make headway somewhere. The nurses, Silent Night, for example, Nottingham Post, Barrow's newspapers. All of these events did not put one penny on the rate, nor one minute off the shift. They were all done in the very best historical connections of trade unionism. And that's one of the things that I'm quite proud of, the fact that we did work hard on other people's behalves, and we were not greedy printers.
Granville?
Well, I'd just like to endorse what John says, because during the miners' strike, I come from Yorkshire, and during the miners' strike, the Sun Chapel, the composing chapel, which was led by John Brown, the father of the chapel, had a magnificent record on challenging some of the vile editorials and coverage that appeared in papers like the Sun. So the writer reply endorses very strongly that broader social, political, trade union connection between Fleet Street and trade union struggles more broadly. It was a magnificent period, and John Brown, thinks back, he reflects on that year as being a great time during the miners' strike to actually put across the record for the miners in their bitter year-long struggle.
Now, Anfield, that question of solidarity is very important, because I think as a journalist covering the dispute, I was always struck by the depth of the solidarity of a group of workers who, of course, come from over a great metropolis like London. It wasn't as though they were in a small mining community, but there was that degree of solidarity. Now, you look back on that dispute. How significant do you think it was that there was that degree of solidarity by the print workers when they were up against it? Do you think that that too is an aspect of this dispute which we must remember?
Well, we had a great public meeting yesterday, and I think one of the points that was made is that the miners' support groups that had sprung up all around the country, but certainly amongst virtually all Fleet Street chapels as well, we were able to use the foundations of those to help print workers. I mean, clearly this did not substitute for the industrial action, the stoppages that really should have occurred, but it meant that in terms of finance and also moral support and support on the pickets and demonstrations, there were plenty of people there. And that also applied with the print workers' support groups in areas like Camden, Southwark, Tower Hamlets, of course, and Newham, that were also affected as communities. And we shouldn't forget either the some of the local authorities who agreed not to take Murdoch papers in the libraries. And local authorities were subject to court action, as well as other unions like the forerunner of the RMT, the NUR, and so on.
Now, Tim Gopsall, you wanted to comment specifically on that question then of solidarity.
The NUJ, the Journalist Union, was also in solidarity with the printers, but for the journalists it was a very difficult time. I was on the executive, and the union was absolutely torn because Murdoch didn't sack the journalists. He needed the journalists to produce the papers, and the journalists knew this. And when the big bang happened that weekend 25 years ago, they had anguished discussions in the journalist chapel. Murdoch offered all the journalists an immediate £2,000 a year pay rise, which was about 10% of most basic wages, to go to Wapping, and eventually about 100 journalists altogether over the period of the dispute, the so-called refuseniks, refused to go, defied the instruction and lost their jobs, and they were on strike along with the printers. But for the union it was difficult, because what a lot of journalists were saying was, now that they had got their hands on the keyboard, that was the phrase, that they took over the direct input of the copy into computers instead of print workers who'd done it before, that they would inherit control of the newspapers in the same way as the printers did. In fact, it was an illusion. And those of us who were involved in picketing the journalists, we used to go down to the gate every morning, and the journalists who were going in, some of them went on the buses that they were laid on, but we used to say to them, look, when Murdoch has dealt with the printers, he will come for you. And he did, but it was very difficult for journalists.
But you mentioned the word, the anguish of the journalists. That's what also struck me, because I went to some of those meetings where the anguish was quite clear. What I think, looking back, was so important was that, of course, a wedge had been driven in the journalistic community during the miners' strike. You were either for or against Margaret Thatcher, either for the strikers or for the working miners. And that, I think, that was exploited too by Murdoch during the Wapping dispute. And, I mean, that was a very significant factor, wasn't it, Tim Gopsall?
It was, yes. I mean, and throughout the dispute, I could tell you, I was on the executive all the way through. And at three consecutive bi-monthly meetings of the NUJ National Executive, there were motions tabled to instruct the members still working in Wapping, the ones who went in, to come out on strike themselves. Most of them said they wouldn't, but the union wanted to take a position. And those three motions, for three meetings running, were defeated by 10-9. That's how close it was.
Now, in our final few moments, I'd like, if we may, to look forward. We've been looking backwards at a dispute, but of course we know that Murdoch is still at the forefront of change within the British news media. Anfield, let's start with you. You have seen and lived through a period, a 25-year period of dramatic change in the print and newspaper industry. What do you think personally is the lesson of what happened in Wapping, and how it relates to the challenges of today?
The lesson of Wapping is that there is no substitute for taking action at the place of work, and no matter how we dress it up, we have to ensure that the anti-union laws are fought against. But even if we're not able to get the anti-union laws repealed, either under this or any other government, that we try to help workers to take action where it counts. Because without workers have the vote every 5 years, but unless they have free, independent, struggling trade unions to defend them, they've got nothing else and they're semi-slaves.
And John Bailey?
Well, for me, it's very clear. I think Murdoch has debauched us all. I think the standards of journalism have gone down. I think most other newspapers have followed Murdoch into the gutter. And Sky Television looks like replicating Fox if he gets an opportunity. So it is in everyone's interest that people like Murdoch are stopped dead.
Granville Williams, if you could give us an overview. Now, you have looked at these changes in media ownership and media practices and the way in which the media is evolving. Do you think we have lessons to learn from Wapping that actually apply in this new electronic age of information?
Yeah, absolutely, because one of the lessons for Wapping was, of course, the collusion between politicians and Murdoch. All the things we've described, the anti-trade union laws, this was part of the Murdoch agenda.
Absolutely.
And now we fast forward, we have seen since the period the chameleon nature of Murdoch's operations. If it's a new Labour government, he'll get them on board. And now we're back with the Conservatives. And my worry is we're doing this interview at a time when we're getting the backdoor dealings and talking between the Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, and the Murdoch Empire. And all of the words we've used, duplicity, the secretness with which things are done. And we need to get things into the open air. If you want, lift up the stone and see what's underneath, what the creepy crawlies are. And I also think I endorse entirely the campaign at the moment which has been made to say we have to stop Murdoch taking over BSkyB. It will create an enormous media monolith which will just distort the free flow of information and journalism in the UK.
And final word to you, Tim Copson?
It goes wider than the media. We are back in the 1980s. Yesterday was a significant day, not just for the Wapping anniversary, but because of the news that the economy went into recession with an actual contraction of the economy in the last 3 months of last year. This is the start of the second and deeper recession. The year 2011 will be a year of slump. And with the public sector spending cuts, the wage freezes, the wage cuts, the job, the unemployment that's coming in this year, workers have again got to start fighting like they did in the 1980s. Now, the trade union wasn't just the printers who were defeated at Wapping, it was the whole trade union movement. And the level of activity in trade unions went down, and it's got to go up again. Now, so far, we have seen the students giving a lead in their protest against tuition fees. The unions have got to fight in the same kind of way. Otherwise, we're going to be in the same repeat of the Thatcher period where unions lose, people lose their jobs, and people suffer. So other workers have got to pick up on the example of the Wapping strikers and fight for their jobs.
Tim Gopsell, thank you very much. I'd like to thank, first of all, Tim Gopsell on behalf of the National Union of Journalists, Anne Field, who was with the print union SOGAT, as it was then described, John Bailey, formerly of the National Graphical Association, and Granville Williams, leading media commentator. This Free Press podcast on the Wapping dispute was produced for the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom by Barry White and Claire Collin.